This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Grant Llewellyn remembers music in his household from his earliest days growing up in southwest Wales. His grandmother used to sit at an old piano in the living room and play enthusiastically, if not always well, from her limited repertoire of waltzes. His parents recognized in young Grant a gift for music and encouraged him to study piano and cello. But in his late teens, he turned to conducting. That career path sent him all over the world and landed him here in North Carolina. Today, Grant Llewellyn is the conductor and music director of the North Carolina Symphony and joins us in the studio today. Grant Llewellyn, welcome to the State of Things. Good to
have you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
North Carolina Symphony is unique in a way because it is a state symphony and it does actually travel the state of North Carolina, isn't it? I mean, that's doesn't happen everywhere.
No. And having said that, there are other state symphonies throughout the United States, and I've worked with any number of them. But none of them, in my experience, come close to the North Carolina Symphony in really servicing the whole state. You know, there are state symphonies in Utah, in Florida. There's the Colorado Symphony. And I've worked with all of those orchestras. They're fine orchestras. But frankly, you know, they rarely get outside of Salt Lake City or Denver or Tampa Bay. So, you know, the North Carolina Symphony is very special in that regard.
And what it says something, I guess, about the state. The fact is you can't travel around if you're not going to have an audience for this thing. So when you get outside of Raleigh, it turns out people are listening all over the state.
Yes, and that's a constant source of joy for me and the musicians. And I'd like to think that we've done something to cultivate that audience outside of the Triangle. We do travel extensively, and of course we give education concerts everywhere we go. And I think over the 80 or so years that we've been in existence, that has built up a sort of grassroots audience wherever we go in North Carolina.
That's interesting all by itself because you'll hear people say certainly symphonic music is dying, nobody's listening to this stuff anymore. But, I mean, is it simply because nobody's trying?
Well, I think exposure is the absolute starting point. And I think until someone has heard a live symphony orchestra, they really don't know what they're missing. There's so much music available at the click of a switch today. It's around us all the time that I don't think people fully appreciate the difference between a recorded CD, DVD, whatever it may be, and just the live sonic experience of a symphony orchestra in the same room as you.
Are you getting younger audiences, or are there younger people in the audience?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what our demographic is. It varies from town to town, from space to space. Certainly, we're continuing our mission of bringing the North Carolina Symphony to 50, 60,000 fourth and fifth graders every year. Now, we don't pretend that they are going to then be lifelong supporters of the North Carolina Symphony, but at least I hope we plant a few seeds. I know we plant a few seeds because there's not an audience that I conduct in North Carolina where individuals come up and say, oh, I first heard the North Carolina Symphony when they came to our elementary school back in the 50s and the 60s or whatever it was. So, you know, we plant those seeds and we hope to see them bloom at whatever stage in that person's life.
You became music director in 2004. Tell us how that happened.
Well, it was an interesting process because I was totally unaware when I first came to town that there was a music director search going on. And maybe that was my manager's wily way of introducing me to the orchestra with no added pressure. I think there's bound to be a certain extra level of anxiety if you're in front of an orchestra for the first time, knowing that you're being considered or you're one of however many candidates for a position there. So I was in blissful ignorance.
And why were you here? What brought you here?
As a guest conductor. Mm-hmm. So I'd been invited to come and conduct the orchestra in the program and turned up and went onto the stage in Maimandi Concert Hall in Raleigh. And within literally minutes, was absolutely captivated by this orchestra in this space. And throughout the course of those rehearsals and that week, I came to the knowledge that indeed there was a search going on, got to know the personnel on stage and off stage, the management team, and had a fantastic experience. So all of a sudden, I was only too happy to throw my hat into the ring formally.
Tell us how that process works. How do you audition for a job like that? Who's paying attention to you, and what are the pressures? Who's judging you?
Well, they had a pretty comprehensive committee here of musicians, in fact, led by musicians in the orchestra, but obviously interested parties from the management, from the board, from the community. We had the Chancellor of the University at Chapel Hill, who was also on the board, Chancellor Meeser at the time, wonderful musician. And it's a long, drawn-out process because no conductor can be available just to sort of fly into town for a series of interviews at any time soon. I mean, you know, if the process was happening today, you know, I would not be available to my diary. I could not make a week or two work very easily for the next 18 months.
Sure. I mean, if you're worth anything, you better be busy.
Well, I suppose there's something in that, yeah.
Something to that. And what about you're getting along with the whole orchestra? I mean, I'm wondering to what extent the marriage of you and the orchestra, the fact that they may take to you, this is not a judgment in the abstract, some kind of skill set that I can look at what Grant Llewellyn brings. I sort of have to figure out the chemistry between you and an awful lot of good musicians. And I wonder how anybody even makes that calculation.
Well, chemistry, I think, is your operative word there, Frank, because many orchestral musicians will tell you that in the first 5 minutes of a rehearsal with a new conductor, they can tell whether they're any good or not. And, you know, there's something in that. I mean, there is a certain dynamic between someone getting on the rostrum and the band that either works or doesn't. I don't believe that it's quite as black and white as that. And I think that obviously over time you get to know an orchestra better and an orchestra gets to know you. And that whole chemistry is very subtle. And so we had the opportunity to work together for at least a couple of weeks before either I or the orchestra were in a position to consider a future, I think.
One of the blessings, I guess, in working in North Carolina, and I can ask you to talk more about that, is the number of musicians you get to work with as you bring a range of talent and a range of genres to the stage. You worked with Tift Merritt in 2007, for example, and we have a sample of that. Let's listen.
Wanna go with you, wanna go with you.
There's the North Carolina Symphony and Tift Merritt doing the song Another Country in a collaboration with the North Carolina Symphony Orchestra. That was back in 2007. A wealth of talent. You've worked with Branford Marsalis, Laura Lynn Dossett, a collaboration coming up, and we're going to talk more about that. When you work with art, and I know you've worked with other composers, too, in this state to put pieces together that have regional significance, do you take into account sort of her work, or how does that collaboration work? Do you look back, listen to her music, and say, how do we reset this orchestra to fit what her sound is?
Yes, all the above. I mean, I listen to a wide range of artists and a wide range of music in preparation for every program. What's fascinating is that when it comes down to the rehearsal process, going back to chemistry again, the chemistry works in exactly the same way, whether it be Laura Lynn Dossett or Lang Lang, you know, a classical pianist at the top of his game. And that's a critical dynamic between the conductor and the soloist. But where there is innate musicianship, whether it be country music or beach music or bluegrass or opera, It's my job to identify that and to make the connection with the artist, to put the artist at ease, to try and bring out the very best in the orchestra. So I don't set any different standards for different genres of music or musician.
Is there resistance among some of the musicians, among members of the audience, in doing these kinds of collaborations? Somehow there is something impure about popular music being on.
One of the great things about this orchestra is the extent to which they do embrace the whole music world. I think maybe, again, going back to our mission as the state symphony, I think we've been a much more all-embracing arts organization than perhaps some symphonies that see themselves as sort of aristocrats of the music world. I'm not interested in that. I think the whole perceived elitism that can go hand in hand with symphony orchestras is the death knell, if there is a death knell. But I don't think we suffer that here. So the musicians in the orchestra are multi-talented. They've got lots of interests. They listen to a lot of these artists as well. And of course, audiences, they're not bound to come and listen to any given concert. Those who subscribe to the classical series, they know that they probably won't get to hear Tiff Merritt, but actually, having said that, they will get to hear Branford Marsalis. And, any number of these artists cross over all the different genres as if they're not, there are no barriers.
We will talk more about that and about the trek from Wales to North Carolina and that living room where Grandma played the piano when Grant Llewellyn joins us and returns on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with North Carolina Symphony Music Director Grant Llewellyn today. Grew up in Southwest Wales. Tell us about those early days listening to music around the house.
Well, it was a pretty rambunctious household. I was the second of four sons. And so there was a fair amount of noise as opposed to music at home. But we did have a family piano. I think many, many families did in those days, stuck in the corner of the living room. And my parents loved to sing. They'd be the first ones to admit that they aren't musically educated, perhaps, but they've both got good voices and good ears, actually. And my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, played the piano after a fashion. Yeah. I remember her as much as I remember the music that she brought out of the instrument. She had a rather sort of sentimental taste in Victorian waltzes. But she was big and cuddly, and so it was a good place to be on a cold Sunday afternoon.
So you remembered that warm. Now, how did you feel about that? That's an interesting connection, because now you can reflect, and it's maybe, I gather from how you said that, not your taste in music. And she may not have been particularly skilled. Am I taking that? Should I infer that?
She most certainly had limited abilities on the keyboard.
How did you? You can do that now. You're a trained musician. You look back and you say that lovingly as you remember your grandmother, so you can see that in your eyes as well. At the time, what were you feeling? I mean, was it grandma play another one? Is there an excitement about, or not? Just stop playing, grandma.
No. I didn't want her to stop playing at all. And I think, at that early age of what must have been, 3-4 years of age, perhaps, visually fascinated by the keyboard, to see that, these black and white notes could translate into these sounds. And yes, I don't say that Victorian waltzes are the peak of my ambition musically, but even they worked along certain melodic and harmonic and rhythmic principles, which was a whole new world to me. And it was an adventure when Grandma went home to try and pick out some of these melodies. And as I found that I could actually reproduce the tunes, I then started experimenting with the harmonies. And, you know, in a very basic way, I found to my amazement and delight that I really could reproduce some of these things. So then it was just opening a whole world of experimentation on the keyboard for me.
Something that apparently your parents noticed.
Yes, yes, they absolutely must have. And I don't know that I've ever really discussed this with them, but I did find myself having piano lessons at the age of 5 or 6.
And did you take once you went from experimenting and the excitement, the raw enthusiasm of learning that you could do this, you could make this happen, to lessons, did your ideas about music change? Was it getting painful?
I don't know that they changed. I mean, it was still very early days, but I suddenly did realize that there was a whole world out there that I could gain access to, even if I couldn't play all the notes. And I think that was that still is a fact of my piano and cello playing. I still try to embrace so much repertoire, even if I can't play it. But to have the facility at least to get a flavor, to get a taste, to get a sense of how a particular phrase works or how a particular composer speaks to us, was a massive adventure for me.
So you were a disciplined student. Did you stick with it?
I was an incredibly undisciplined student, I think. I just loved to play. I think I must have driven my teachers mad because, you know, it would have been a good thing if I'd studied the exercises and the scales and the arpeggios a little more. But at that early age, I suppose I had an ability to grasp the musical concepts pretty quickly. And that meant that I was able to progress through the exam system, the local music exam system, very quickly, probably too quickly for my own good. It meant that I was trying to play pieces that were too difficult for me without the basic foundations, groundings of a good technique.
So you got some early musical training and you went off to a school that and specialized at a fairly early age, right?
Yes. Well, that was the most significant move at the age of 11, by then having studied the cello also for a couple of years. I went from this sort of bucolic existence in southwest Wales to a grimy northern industrial city in Manchester, northern England, but to what was a specialist music school of about 250 students. And that was an extraordinary change of everything, of lifestyle. I was away from my family and my brothers and my parents. But it was so musically exciting that I don't think I really thought too much about the wrench out of the family unit.
Were you imagining yourself as a professional musician at that age, 11 years old?
No, I don't think I had any illusions about that. I didn't know what the music profession entailed. I'd come up through an obviously limited musical community in that corner of Wales, where I'd progressed pretty quickly through the youth music system, but playing in the Pembrokeshire School's Symphony Orchestra was a far cry from the prospects of making a career. And so it wasn't really until my teens that I was exposed to real professional musicians. And that's a whole different ballgame.
You talked about the youth music system. What was the system? What was the pathway to music in Great Britain at the time?
Well, I was very lucky in Wales at the time. Apart from the fact that the whole society, the whole community, had music as part of the furniture. My parents sang. My mother sang in the church choir. People would sing at rugby matches. People would sing in the pubs, obviously, in church and in school. So there was music making around. And at school, at the age of eight or nine, everybody was given the opportunity to learn an instrument of their choice. And, you know, looking back, that was an incredible luxury. And I decided on the cello, and we had what we called peripatetic teachers who'd come to school and start you off on whatever instrument. And then if you showed any interest, promise, that would feed into a school orchestra. There were school choirs. And then there would be a regional orchestra, what we call a county orchestra, which would feed into the National Youth Orchestra of Wales. So that was the path as you call it. But that didn't necessarily lead into the profession, but that was just what everybody assumed a civilized society would have.
And you chose the cello. Were pretty darn good at it, would you say?
I was okay on the cello. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I could probably have made something of a career as a cellist. Again, you know, I had the same drawbacks as on the piano, that I just loved to play and wasn't wild about practicing, but would play. I mean, this school was incredible. I played the cello for probably 3 or 4 hours every day in a variety of string quartets and symphony orchestras and recitals. And so there was music coming out of the woodwork in that school. And I devoured as much of it as I could possibly get my hands on.
When did you decide to pursue conducting?
Well, I think that was a slow process, a realization that came through school, where I already had the opportunity to study conducting from the age of 14 or 15. This school provided conducting lessons. But almost more important than the lessons, I was already keen enough, enthusiastic enough to get together groups of friends and put on concerts, whether it was a chamber orchestra or a chamber choir, just to, you know, cajole and persuade and bully my mates to come along and, hey, why don't we play through this Stravinsky serenade or whatever it may be? And so I arrived at the age of about 18 contemplating university or music school, and that was the big choice. Most of the students were going off to conservatory, one of the, you know, major music schools in Britain, and I decided already not to put all my eggs in that one basket. I was fascinated with this thing called conducting. I already knew that it opened up such a broad spectrum of music to me. That was the main attraction at that stage. I didn't really know what it entailed professionally. So I took a year out. I went to Italy and studied the cello really seriously, with no other distraction. Well, a few other distractions, but no other students to compete with. All I think that was the big thing. And it dawned on me there that I would go back to university and neglect the cello in favor of conducting. Mm. That was the decision.
Was it difficult for you to leave the cello, to stop playing with the intensity that you had been?
Not really. First of all, I didn't stop playing. You know, I played a lot at university. And as I say, you know, I'm not sure that I ever played it with enough intensity in the first place. I still played passionately and loved it, but I wasn't studying with a view to pursuing it as a profession. And so that took the pressure. Actually, in some ways, I may even have enjoyed it more because it suddenly took that pressure and expectation away.
And now you're expected to be a conductor. Did you understand fully, and I'm going to get you to explain to us fully, what the conductor does? What are you getting yourself into?
I had no idea. I just knew that there was a lot of music out there that I loved. And as a conductor, I might have the luxury of picking and choosing more than if I wasn't a conductor. As to what the profession entailed, yes, I played in symphony orchestras pretty much all my life, and I'd observed many conductors up close, and there's a certain fascination, attraction to leading the music and trying to motivate and inspire a group of musicians to perform together. I played a lot of sport. I think already at that age I was drawing parallels between playing soccer as one of a team, and especially as a captain of a soccer team, you know, trying to get the rest of the team to work together and to play to the best of their ability, but to play as one. And that fascinated me. So some of those same interests I felt could feed into conducting.
Well, if we stick with the metaphor and your comparison to sport, yeah, and there are rules, and everybody's got to know the rules, and we have to play together and all of that, and yet each game is different, and every team we play against is different, so that requires a certain amount of, let's call it, interpretation and improvisation to get around a particularly good goalie or midfielder. To what extent can you, particularly when it comes to that body of symphonic music that we may all be all too familiar with, bring your own interpretation? Is that your job, or are you measuring yourself against some standard interpretation that you have to bring to the orchestra?
Well, you absolutely have to bring your own conviction to a piece, your own vision of it. And that doesn't mean to say that you have to go out on a limb just for the sake of it and be original. There's probably no new information to be learnt from Beethoven symphonies. Though every single time I go back to a Beethoven symphony that I may have conducted 40, 50 times before, I find new things in it for myself. And you go into a new acoustic with a new group and it always feels slightly different. Thank God. I mean, it keeps it alive and fresh. And so, yes, you have to bring conviction to the music making, first and foremost. That is absolutely the bottom line. But then, of course, you have to live in the real world and accept that every group is different. Every group has different strengths and weaknesses. And you, to continue the sporting metaphor, you have to draw on the individual talents of your team so that when they've got the ball, you know, they can actually do incredible things with it, use all their unique skills, but understand that they are just one of 11 players on that. And we're talking soccer here, by the way, Frank. So they're just one of 11 players on that field, and they better work together. Otherwise, they're going to lose.
Well, it's easier for us. It gets the scale down so to something manageable and understand. Well, to what extent do you have to, let's say, adjust your vision to the orchestra? You're going to have certain strengths, and there may be certain weaknesses in every orchestra. There have to be. And you bring a vision, and you find out, well, we just, in this particular setting, I may not be able to hear it quite that way from this group for one reason or another. I mean, is that an adjustment that you consciously make? You say, you know, the strength is here and perhaps not there.
Yes, you absolutely do that instinctively whilst trying to be uncompromising in your vision. And you bend over backwards. And again, you know, I use the words cajole and persuade and bully and all, the whole range of tools at your disposal to get to your image of how that particular piece should sound. But whether it be the Boston Symphony or, you know, the Triangle Youth Orchestra, you have strengths and weaknesses. And so you obviously try to build on the strengths and nullify the weaknesses. But yeah, we have to live in the real world whilst being idealistic.
Do most conductors come to the profession as conductors? This is something they train for and want to become. I know there are some, you know, sort of celebrities who may, after a long career, retire in a sense to conducting, although it seems to me that it's a profession that you need to be at most of your life, isn't it?
Well, I'd like to think that it's skilled enough to take, you know, a lifetime's experience. Certainly there are some leading instrumentalists who have come to conducting during the course of their playing careers. And, you know, when you're talking about Vladimir Ashkenazy or Mstislav Rostropovich or Placido Domingo, for that matter, they have enjoyed work at the very top of their particular skill working with the world's greatest conductors. And so as open-minded musicians, they've picked up so much along the way, which stands them in very good stead as conductors themselves. Though there are still certain technical requirements the conductors have, and whilst they're nothing like as sophisticated as playing an instrument, it can make a difference when you're standing in front of 80, 90 musicians. If you give the wrong gesture, it can be chaotic out there. So I don't think it should be approached lightly. Having said that, there's no one easy career path for conductors. You know, if a talented young musician came up to me and said, okay, you know, what are the five things I have to do? Where do I have to study? And then what do I have to do? I'm not going to be able to advise them that much. There are a handful of programs around the world that would teach mostly postgraduate conducting for a year or two. And there are a couple of summer programs. But then you're out there on your own. And it's pretty tough to break into.
Is it possible, do you think, to be an accomplished conductor and not play an instrument, not have played an instrument?
I would say no, or being an accomplished singer. But I think it's almost impossible to conceive of somebody who has not experienced music making, hands-on music making, because that's the spark for wanting to make the music yourself. You know, if you haven't played and sung or, you know, even hit a percussion instrument, then I can't conceive of why anybody would want to be a conductor.
Well, you know, you can imagine these sort of aficionados who are these, people who appreciate the sound and can hear it and just can't get their fingers and feet to make it all happen.
Yeah, there's a certain fascination with, you know,
critics,
the kind of power
critics,
surge.
For instance.
I thought, didn't it say we had to avoid that?
I tell you, this is a perfect place to take a break, don't you think? My guest is Grant Llewellyn, music director and conductor of the North Carolina Symphony. Just ahead, we'll talk a little bit more about his career and a little bit more about his background. Our conversation continues on the state of things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with North Carolina Symphony Music Director Grant Llewellyn from Southwest Wales down to North Carolina and all over the world. But tell me about your first time coming to the United States. How did you feel about that, and when you got here, the scene?
Well, it was an interesting occasion. I was just out of postgraduate school at the Royal College of Music in London. And I was auditioning for a place at the Tanglewood Music Centre in the Berkshire Hills, where the Boston Symphony spend their summer, which certainly at the time was the preeminent conducting program in the world, really. So I flew into Boston in January, first time in the States, and certainly first time in that kind of climate. That was a shock to the system alone. Mm-hmm. But fascinated by the world and the culture of New England and the Boston Symphony. I came back. I was lucky enough to win a fellowship and came back for nearly 3 months that summer. And it was an overwhelming experience musically as well as just culturally. I think people assume that New England in particular is as close to European culture as you can get in the United States. To me, it just felt as foreign as anywhere on continental Europe.
How so? Why?
Well, just I think you notice the differences rather than the similarities. I certainly as a visitor for the first time.
But what
and
are
I
they?
Delighted in the...
Yeah, but what are they?
Well, everything from the flora and the fauna to the architecture and you know, people had strange accents.
Oh, I see. I wondered if the music or just the way people approached music or appreciated music or any of that.
Well, I think that was quite heartening in that I noticed the similarities there rather than the differences. I mean, one of the great things about Tanglewood and the Boston Symphony is that it's you know, it is a world-class organization, and during the course of the 9-10 weeks that I was studying there, we were working very closely with pretty much every ranking conductor of the day. Leonard Bernstein was there, Seiji Ozawa was the music director, Kurt Mazur came from the Leipzig Gewandhaus, Simon Rattle from Birmingham, John Elliott Gardner, Michael Tilson Thomas, Charles Dutoit. And, you know, I mean, it really was an international cast of conductors, which was reassuring in a sense, because it pointed out the common voices that we all had. You know, we were working on Beethoven symphonies, and the Beethoven symphony didn't mean anything different to me in Massachusetts to what it meant to me in London. And I could see through the eyes of these other visiting conductors that they, each of them, had their own unique take on it as well. So there was no great sort of cultural challenge. It was an individual and artistic musical challenge that we were all faced with. So it was overwhelming just because there were so many big names and big personalities to try and digest. You know, Leonard Bernstein alone is a massive feat. To try and work out where he was coming from and how he could combine the excesses of his personal life and style with the humility of his music making. Hmm.
Could you? I'm going to ask you about that. Do you learn from people like this? And there are big names. It's certainly inspiring for you to think you're there. You talked about the commonalities, but can you learn anything technically in that relatively short time?
Yes, technically you can learn things, and from, you know, more from certain individuals than others. Going back to that summer, it was quite alarming at times to see some of the mistakes that people would make, not just in the conducting class, but in front of the Boston Symphony.
Oh, give us one.
Come on. Oh, now we're talking. Well, okay, like... And he would forgive me if he was alive, I'm sure. I mentioned Leonard Bernstein, who is perhaps the greatest musical communicator, period, that I've ever come across. One of the most athletic minds, one of the most brilliant, encyclopedic knowledge. And I loved him to death. And in 1985, which was the year I was at Tanglewood, it was the 85th birthday year of Aaron Copland. And Copland came, and of course Leonard Bernstein had been his sort of amanuensis for years, and so he sort of led him around a little bit by the hand. It was rather sad. Copland was already beginning to suffer from Alzheimer's, but wonderful to have the great man there. So Lenny was conducting the Third Symphony of Copland in the 81st birthday concert, and there's the fanfare for the common man at the beginning of it, which is this extraordinary, wonderful outburst with the brass and the percussion. And you've got all the heavy brass blazing away, and you've got big bass drums and timpani all having to coordinate this fanfare. It's not a straightforward fanfare in terms of the beat patterns, in that it comes on the outbursts come on different beats of the bar, and you better be clear in your preparation for each explosion of the brass and the bass drum. And I have to say that it was very clear to me that Leonard Bernstein actually screwed up one of these entries and almost caused a massive train wreck. Now, on the one hand, that was kind of heartening to see that the great man can also be human. On the other hand, it taught me that actually that wasn't what was important about that performance. What was important about that performance was that the players played out of their skins.
Wow.
For this guy.
Let me stop you right there. Let me ask you, if I would have noticed that, would I have felt some sense of train wreck, some sense of offbeat that something had happened, or would I have?
I think you would have in that particular performance. If you'd been listening intently, yeah. There was a kind of frightening moment there where half the brass section almost came in on the wrong note, on the wrong beat. And it was entirely due to the conductor's gesture. And, that was a salutary moment.
And yet, as you say, he had inspired a kind of intensity in their play that night that that I may have noticed as well. And maybe you come away from that performance talking about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think anybody will have remembered that moment. But for me as an aspiring conductor, it was a fascinating moment.
Gives you a sense of freedom, I guess, then. Oh, if Bernstein can do it, well, I'm okay up there.
And stuff happens.
Yeah.
You know, that's the beauty of live music, is that you are on the edge. And not that you're forever avoiding train wrecks, but, you know, you better know your stuff. And one of our responsibilities is to be clear. And occasionally, you know, especially in very emotional moments and emotional music, you almost have a responsibility to be, dare I say, dispassionate, or at least to stand at a distance that enables you to do your job.
Right.
I'll never forget when I was at Cambridge University conducting Richard Strauss's Metamorphosen. This is an extraordinary outpouring, a late work of Strauss's, for 23 solo strings. And it builds and builds and builds up to this incredible climax. And, you know, I was tearing my hair out and sweating and turning somersaults. And at one point, the leader of the violins leaned across to me and she said, "Do you know what? You know, this is an amazing moment, but I think you're getting in the way. We don't know where to play." And of course, we feel the passion and we love that, but we need to know where to play as well. And, you know, that's actually...
So then your job then is to both, but you still have to communicate that passion and stay in control of your body so that you're giving very clear signals, but you can't look like you don't care.
Oh, right? God forbid, God forbid.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's nothing more unsettling for an orchestra if your gestures are ambiguous.
Even with all the preparation, forgive me again, I'm interrupting you, but even with all the preparation, the idea that we've gone over this a few times, we know when you come in. So I've been very clear that I need you to come in. It comes in a different part of the bar here, so be aware of that. You can't just tap your foot to this one. But that night, I throw my shoulder the wrong way and the timpani comes in the wrong time, or the brass comes in the wrong time.
It can happen.
Yeah.
It has happened. And of course, in rehearsal, whilst you're trying to communicate the emotions of a particular piece, you tend not to rack up the emotional level to the same degree as you do in performance. I mean, you've got to leave something for the night. So, you know, when you come to the performance and the adrenaline's pumping and you've got an audience behind you, you do have to try and keep some sense of proportion. Otherwise, everything would be faster and louder and slower and softer, and it would just be an indulgent, excessive experience.
Are there pieces for you that are real challenges, pieces that you come that you just wish you could get them down? They've been tormenting you. You know there's something there and you've never quite gotten the best out of it.
There are lots of pieces. There are certain specific composers with whom I struggle, whom I can admire as a student of music, and I'm very good at writing essays about them, but I have struggled to come to terms with their particular musical voice.
For instance?
Well, as long as no one's listening out there, I'll tell you that I've had problems with Berlioz, for instance. You know, one of the great figures in French music and the development of symphonic music in music history. And I am fascinated by him. It was an incredible mind and a great spirit. But so often when I come to studying his music, and I do conduct Berlioz, I feel a little bit at a loss as to where the music is going. And that's disorientating. And I would hate to think that it all has to be simplistic and clearly laid out for me. But as a conductor, you do have to feel a sort of a gut reaction to music. And if you don't know where a phrase is going or a particular rhythm or a melody, then it's impossible to shape that melody. So I've struggled a little bit with him. I'm hoping that, you know, in time,
And does the study help a little bit? I mean, so people have written about that. They've struggled with the same things. Critics have sort of pointed the way. But I take it then just the intellectual understanding of that, those answers, getting those answers doesn't...
That hasn't done it for me yet. Maybe I just need to go and live in France for a bit and immerse myself in that whole culture. Although he was a maverick even there.
You know, I think you should just suggest that to the board.
That I should go and live in France?
That you should spend a few months in France just getting Berlioz down.
But I'd need to take the orchestra with me.
Then there you go. Well, I'm behind you 100%. I think it's a great suggestion. Is there a composer like that you have worked on and had an epiphany that you've worked on and said, oh, that's what it is?
Yes, I would say that's the case with Wagner and with Bruckner going back. Now, it's as a student... I struggled at times with Wagner opera. Mm. Again, it was almost like too much information for a teenager. I could, of course, appreciate certain harmonies and certain overtures, but, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And does it come to you from listening over and over, or is there one moment or one particular performance where you think, oh, that's got it?
I think that in the case of Wagner, it was with an increasing understanding of the symphonic tradition out of which he emerged. So that as I became more and more comfortable and experienced with the whole Beethoven, Schubert, Schumann, Mendelssohn, Brahms, Liszt world that leads inevitably, inexorably, into the world of Wagner, suddenly, the coin did drop. And I think there's just something to be said for immersing yourself in that sound world of Wagner for a while. It should probably be forbidden for 20-year-olds to conduct Wagner. I think you should be made to wait until you're in your 50s.
Well, but it also points to something that's pretty interesting for the rest of us who have come to appreciate symphonic music over time, and that is, for me, the pathway really was understanding the historical and cultural context, just as you said, and understanding what was happening historically, culturally, and how those changes were taking place and how the music reflected and also propelled some of those movements. And then I could listen for patterns and much more deeply appreciate simply the aesthetic experience. But I needed some grounding and context, and I would say that's good advice for anybody who wants to get into this.
Absolutely. I go back to Bach and start from there and work your way through Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven. And there is a very logical theme that emerges, and you can follow that theme all the way through.
And you get to hear that Beethoven was a rebel. It's not all the same. For those of us who thought that, Mozart and Beethoven sound alike, and then you realize, oh, no. He was screaming at those guys. He really was telling them there's a whole new way of approaching music.
He was the worst of them, worst and the best simultaneously. Yeah, he pushed his orchestral musicians beyond what their instruments were ever invented to do, to say nothing for his audiences.
And didn't like his teacher, Papa Haydn, very much. And there you go.
Yeah, well, how many people out there like their teachers?
Grant Llewellyn, what a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Grant Llewellyn is music director and conductor of the North Carolina Symphony. For more information about that and an upcoming concert, I want to talk to you about Laura Lynn Dossick, because you've got about 30 seconds left, and that is a concert that you are doing with her. Tell us about that.
Well, we've got a unique collaboration. Laura Lynn's a wonderful composer, singer-songwriter in the folk tradition, and we are presenting what's called The Gathering, which will be with a string band, a country string band, banjos and mandolins and guitars. And it's very much a Thanksgiving theme. It's a sort of a winter's tale and should warm the hearts of anyone who can come and hear it.
Great stuff. And Laura Lynn, of course, has written a lot of music for the Triad stage and original shows up there. And now we'll be on the stage with Grant Llewellyn and the North Carolina Symphony. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. If you want to hear an archived edition of a past program, go to stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.